Welcome to Fitter Radio, proudly supported by Garmin, the endurance athlete's leading brand for wrist-based GPS wearables, bike computers and power meters. Visit garmin.co.nz today.
Hello, from Vancouver.
Hello, Bevan.
From Vancouver.
And hello from Bristol.
Bristol. So, is this a first? No, we must
have. This is totally a first. We were both abroad in different countries.
Yeah, an idiot abroad. So, did you see that program on TV?
No, but I heard about it. Hilarious.
But the vegetarian, I guarantee you the vegetarian would have loved that. That's English humour down to
yes.
A T.
Yes, I'm sure.
Now,
hi, Bevan.
I'm not too bad. Have you just returned to civilization from Spanish mountains?
Yeah, we returned on Tuesday night, and oh my God, Spain was amazing. So we were staying in Almanaca, yep. Which is just like a little Spanish villagey type thing up a mountain, which was like 20 minutes from the center, but there was no internet connection. The roads weren't paved. We went running and were chased by rabid dogs, which were like strays.
They go around in packs. Portugal and Spain and Italy as well. When you see them coming, you're like, shit.
Yeah, pretty much. And thankfully, the ones that were after us were really old and slow, and they nipped the vegetarian. probably because he was veggie. They were like, nah. But thankfully, we were able to outrun them. But my God, talk about freaky. But I flew into Madrid, and the vegetarian met me there, and we had a fabulous like evening there.
Yep.
So hot, like ridiculously hot. And then we also had a night in Granada as well, which was amazing. Unreal.
So romantic.
It was really romantic. And it was just, but you know, just the whole city was romantic, and the history is just like phenomenal. We did a bus tour. Not really. You just kind of jump on, jump off. And we jumped off at this bar because we were with his sister and her husband. Yep. And we went in, and you just got this vista. I sent you a picture, actually.
Yeah.
Didn't really. I don't know that you would have seen it, but of the Alhambra Castle, and it, my God, blown away. It was.
Yeah.
They call it the eighth wonder of the world, right? And I can see why. It was spectacular.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, look, any part of Europe through there, it's one of the things I love about it the most is the old world architecture, and you know, it's just something that we don't have in New Zealand as much.
No, like we were running this morning, so we have had to kind of just manipulate our running to kind of suit the requirements. So we did a long run this morning, and just as we were running out of Dunstable, which is where his parents live, I looked and saw that the town sign said established 1109. And I'm like, oh my God, you forget that time actually exists back then. Like, it's only ever on the movies and stuff when you see it.
Hey, look. Do you know what's incredible now? You've met the entire family. The vegetarian's met your family. You've met his family. I hear what? Wedding bells? And
we're
this is the episode
married.
That we announced.
Cut that out.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Sound engineer Chris, cut that segment out. Not.
Yeah.
So now you're running around Bristol.
We've just arrived in Bristol for a music festival tomorrow, seeing Elbow.
Nice, I like it.
Yeah, and a number of other acts, and his sisters and their husbands are coming up, and so we just arrived in a house we're renting, and it's just, do you know the other thing is that the houses all look really cold from the outside, and then of course you go in and they're like super warm.
Yeah.
That is another thing which blows my mind.
Well, You lived in Dunedin, which at similar temperatures to the UK, the houses were not designed for the temperature. The Brits have got it sorted, double glazing.
They really do. But Bevan, the other thing is that the Brits all immigrated to New Zealand, right? Or immigrated. Which one is it?
Emma.
And although they did not have the same materials available to them to build the similar houses, you would have thought that they would have, I don't know, thought more about heating when they used what they had. Because even Auckland's rubbish.
Oh, so now you're actually blaming historically the people that travelled to New Zealand and not actually thought at any stage that maybe someone in Dunedin themselves in the more modern centuries had twigged to the fact that, shit, we should actually insulate the houses a bit better.
Oh, they did that in the 70s, but it wasn't the 1470s. It was the 1970s, and no one could afford to do anything about it.
There's been no need for insulation since we've been here in Canada. You know, 25 to early 30s, every single day, apart from the day that the Quathlon was on in Penticton, which was freezing, because the wind was coming off the lake, much like it does in Wanaka in New Zealand. But we've just been enjoying just really, really beautiful, consistent blue skies, 25 plus, every single day. It's not a hardship.
No, look, I can imagine. And I love Canada. I've only been there once or twice in the same trip, as you know, last year, and I just am looking forward to going back. It's such a beautiful country.
Absolutely. We're in Vancouver at the moment. Penticton was fabulous. It's, you know, it was just brilliant for the festival. We spoke about it last week in the episode and just talked about how Penticton was a really, really brilliant choice for the first ITU multi-sport festival where all the races came together. Finding venues like that around the world are going to be what's going to make or break that particular event, I think, because it was just the weather conditions were just fantastic. And Canada, I love Canada as well. We're here in Vancouver. We're off to Vancouver Island today. This week's been a little bit of my holiday week, and last week was work, and then we go into work by going to altitude at Boulder once sound engineer Chris flies home early next week. So we're on a little bit of a holiday at the moment.
Fantastic. And I hear you're off to Vancouver Island, is that right?
Yeah, which I, because this is the second time I've been to Vancouver, I actually love Vancouver as a city. I think I could definitely live here, although a lot of the locals are talking about the cost of living being really, really high now because it is such a popular city. But, I mean, sound engineer Chris has just left now to go and run in Stanley Park, which is you would absolutely love if you haven't already run there. It's just off the waterfront, really accessible from town. You know, there's multiple trails and paths that go through this little headland area in Vancouver itself. It's set up for everything over here. And, you know, I like the Canadians by default are really, really cool people. And I think Kiwis and Canadians get on really, really well.
I reckon. I think it's something to do with that kind of we're very similar in terms of our relationship with the closest country to us, right?
Yep.
So Australians and the people in the States, lovely, both of them. I do love Australians, but it's that similar kind of big brother, younger brother type relationship.
Yep. Now talk to me. What shoes are you wearing at the moment?
Oh, I'm not wearing them, but don't you like them?
What are they?
The Campers.
Is that a brand?
Yeah, it's a brand. It's a really it's a really expensive in New Zealand brand, and it's been around forever. And I don't know. Are they German?
Well, hold on. Didn't they sponsor our America's Cup in some way? I'm pretty sure I've seen that logo or brand somewhere else. Did you buy them in Spain?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe that's a Spanish brand.
Maybe it is.
Are they running or fashion shoes, or are they festival-going music shoes so you don't slip on the dance floor?
No, well, they are probably the latter, but they're totally fashion. They will go with everything and nothing, which is exactly the kind of shoe
to the listeners, I'm currently looking at an image that Mickey's just texted through to me. Yes, correct. They look like probably rock climbing shoes in terms of the grip on the sole and the fluorescent orange color to the entire body of the shoe. It's unique. You're right. It'll go with your jeans at this stage and it'll be perfect for a music festival.
Totally will be. Hey, and Bevan, I did the longest run I've done since Gold Coast this morning.
Ooh, how far?
29K.
Oh, nice. Solid. Happy
I know.
With that?
Yeah, so we've just continued to train for Queenstown, and thankfully we had a download week last week in Spain because it would have been really difficult to do a lot of sessions there, but we did like some efforts on Monday morning and it was like 24 degrees or something, and really early in the morning, as I'm sure you'll appreciate with what you were just talking about with the temperature in Canada.
Yeah.
But this morning it was, it's the first September, and it was 12 degrees. So actually, I know in New Zealand it's the start of spring, but here, of course, it's the start of, or at least calendar autumn, but it just felt like a spring run, and it was so good.
Oh, beautiful. 29 Ks is a nice, solid effort.
I know, and it's funny, you forget how your body responds to stuff like that. So, like today, I'm like, oh, the underbit of my foot's a bit sore, my Achilles is a bit sore, I need to stretch. But you forget all of that stuff when you kind of embark on training for something, if it's been forever since you've actually trained for anything.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it sounds like things are moving in the right direction. Is it going to be like a mano a mano race between you and the vegetarian at the Queenstown Marathon?
No, he'll whip my ass. He's still a good half hour faster than me. But you know, I love the fact that I'm training again, and you forget that you get faster when you train rather than just run, you know? And it's not till you have it evidenced in front of you, like, actually that felt far easier than what it would have, you know, like 12 weeks ago or whatever.
Well, no.
I know. It's been forever. But more importantly, in Spain, Bevan, really good quality wine was like €2 for a bottle.
Yeah. You don't need to convince me. Perfect. Let's make a trip there next year.
Yeah. Cheese, ridiculously cheap. And like produce, like food was actually really cheap. Like we went, like because the euro to the Kiwi dollar is actually pretty good right now. And we went like to the supermarket and you got like a big shop. And I was thinking, this has got to be about €300. And it's like €150 or something. I know.
You're making just money. You're making money. Yeah. Now, I've got to tell you, I got accosted, well, I'm not going to say accosted, but approached by a podcast fan a number of them, and we'll give them a shout out. Firstly, Karen Telford put a message up on our Facebook page when we got to Penticton saying, love to meet you, fan of the show. And I'm walking down the street, and I just had a Fit a Radio t-shirt on, and she comes barreling across the street with one of her training partners and spotted us straight away. So it was fantastic to catch up with Karen. But then Tony Weeks from the UK, actually, I was in the finishers area after the race doing media duties and so forth. And Tony came up to me and said, you know, fan of the podcast, and said, Mickey changed his life in 2015. Yeah.
Oh, great. Tell me about this.
So LCHF. So he's been on that particular journey in various stages throughout the time, trying to get the family involved. But he's been listening for the last couple of years and, you know, was singing your praises, basically. So, Tony, I actually don't know where Tony's from. You'll probably bump into him at the music festival this weekend.
Great, Bevan. I'm so pleased that people approach you at events like that, because there's nothing cooler than getting people to just come up and say hello and that they listen to the show and stuff. And, yay, I love those warm fuzzy.
Oh, absolutely. It was funny because we were also standing on the corner. And, like, do you know, as an audio podcast, what's bizarre is I was going to pick up my media pass and something like that. And I was in the race hotel, and Jen Gregory from Triathlon New Zealand, who I had never met before, immediately shouts out to me and recognised me from a photo. And I, like, that's an unusual sort of situation to be in. You don't expect that. But we're standing on the side of the street, and I think it was during the race, during the bike leg of the elites was finishing, And Mike Rickey from D3 Multisports, who's based in Boulder, and I've known of D3 Multisports. He's got a wonderful coaching company. I think he was USAT Coach of the Year in 2015 or something like that. So really respected coach. I don't physically know what he looks like, but I'm talking to sound engineer Chris, and Mike comes across and says, "I recognize your voice." And he listens to the podcast as well, and it's like I was recognized just from saying something in public, and it was really bizarre. But no, we had a number of people in Penticton sort of message us, and you know, when they were there took the opportunity to say hi and so forth. So it was really cool to think about the fact that we're, you know, reaching people in Canada and the UK, and we're going to hopefully bump into them at some of the major events that we get to.
That's awesome, Bev.
Now, actually, on that note, talking about that long distance triathlon, that particular yes. distance, okay, 3Ks, 120Ks. 30Ks, really was fabulous to go and spectate over that particular distance for the elites and the age groupers. Now, the elites were coming in just over 5 hours, and you know, I think maybe 5:15. I'm not absolutely sure of their finishing time. They were approaching it basically like a 70.3 and holding on for dear life at the end. Watching them come across the finish, Lionel Sanders, Josh Amberger, Heather Wirtel, they were absolutely shot. You know, they had, like, it's funny, at the elite press conference beforehand, they talked about how they were going to actually approach the race. And it's quite interesting because, you know, some people will turn around and say, well, is it require more an Ironman mentality, or does it require maybe a 70.3 mentality, so that, you know, you're going as hard as you can for as long as you can? And they definitely approached it with a 70.3 mentality. They were basically just going as fast as they humanly could. So to see them so spent by that extra distance was really, really interesting to see. And then from the age group perspective, you know, you had a lot of the age group is really starting to take those 6, 7, potentially 8 hours to complete the event. So it really is a true test of endurance. So what I'm actually leading to is the Port of Tauranga Half in New Zealand is launched their new long distance triathlon event, which is called the Enduro, and it's happening on the 20th of January next year. It gives the Kiwi athlete and those travelling from, let's say, further afield, Australia or, you know, the Pacific in some way, or even further than that. So you get the 3K swim, the 120K bike ride, and a 25K run. So it's not quite what we saw in Penticton, but it's close enough. I think it's a really, really great opportunity for those people who are either training for Ironman or potentially looking at doing something a little bit longer than obviously a 70.3 that does really have that unknown element of balancing speed versus endurance. We definitely want to make sure that people go to the website, Mount Festival of Multisport, look up that particular distance, the Enduro long distance race. There's also the Half Ironman still available, so that classic distance from one of the longest standing races in New Zealand. But it was really such a cool race to watch because it did just have that extra element to it that a lot of people in New Zealand actually haven't had a chance to race over. So I would thoroughly recommend that people investigate that, because it will also be a qualifying event if people want to go to the ITU Long Distance Worlds in Denmark in 2018. And from our experience of watching what went on in Penticton and talking to both the professional and the age group athletes, they loved the week-long festival, and it really is, I think, going to be an event that just gains more and more momentum as more of these versions of it actually happen over the next few years. So if you're looking to see what that distance feels like, then definitely go to the Mount Multisport page and look at the Enduro long distance, because it'll be your first opportunity in January 2018 to actually have a go at it.
I reckon it sounds awesome, Bevan. Just for, you know, we've had, like you say, the Tauranga has been there forever and it's a fabulous event. Equally, it's so good to have something, if you want something else a little different to focus on, then doing that enduro event would be, it's a real challenge, I think.
Oh, definitely.
And like you say, like how to race it. Like, I think that's really interesting. Like the distances sound like 120K bike. Is that what you said?
Yeah. It's just it was really interesting. It was just that fascinating in between distance, which it classically is. But to see, you know, man, it was, I mean, I was gathering interviews at the end, at the finish line. So, you know, I've got access as the pros come across the finish line. You had to give them 15 minutes to gather themselves. They were absolutely rooted. So it's great to see race organizers nowadays actually thinking of moving outside what is typically half Ironman and Ironman and giving us more options.
Now, Bevan, how did you feel being part of the media and not racing? Like I know that, you know, this is a year off for you and it's not like you're, and that's a decision you've made and obviously you're happy with it, but did you get a sense of wanting to be out there, or were you happy enough just to be doing the interview?
No, I must admit it was like watching that particular race, I would have loved to have been involved in that race. I just think it's, when I did the ITU World Champs long distance in China a few years ago, they'd shortened the run to 20Ks. So,
that's right.
But it was a longer swim. It was a 4K swim, 120K bike and a 20K run. I just wanted to get that balance and have a go at that particular longer run as well. So, yes, it did. But I know thoroughly enjoying the opportunity to be part of the actual official media at events now. It's, you know... I've actually, over the years, built relationships with a number of the professionals on the start line. I mean, at the elite briefing, I think 90% of the people on the panel we'd actually interviewed for the podcast, so we sort of knew them already. And increasing our accessibility as podcasters to these people and to the big names in the sport and producing podcasts from the events, you know, like we went out Monday morning or Monday afternoon, actually, because it took us a while to edit everything into it. So we would have been one of the first podcasts to be made available after such a major event. And our, you know, sound engineer, Chris, and I listened to the podcast that we produced for that particular race. And we're really, really proud of the content. You know, there was, we might have had 10 to 15 different professional voices over the course of the podcast. We captured most of the leading race contenders and finishers and podium place getters. And, you know, we wouldn't be able to do that if we didn't actually travel to the event. It would become a completely different kettle of fish. You know, it comes at an expense to us to actually get there, but, you know, it's worth it at the end of the day once we see what we can do when we're there. So, it's a balancing act, and I think, well, you know, I'll get back into doing a race without it actually affecting the podcast. So, you know, I can feel the juices are starting to flow a little bit more.
Oh, that's cool. That's a cool place to be in, I think.
Yeah. Hey, I'd prefer to be at the event in some capacity than not be there at all.
So totally.
At the moment, it's definitely podcast focus. And look, next week I'll be at the Santa Cruz 70.3 in San Fran before obviously heading up to Boulder to do our altitude training camp. So, you know, as part of our trip here to the Penticton and to the long distance worlds, we're going to be able to bring to the podcast listeners the real experience of training at altitude in Boulder. That's part of this particular journey as well. And then on to, you know, Kona again in October. So I think, you know, we're at the moment, whilst I'm not racing, I'm pretty much having a great time doing the other things as well.
Yeah, awesome.
Right. We better get into the meat of the podcast. So we've got a workout of the week, and I'm going to talk Training Peaks and a little bit about how to use the TSB number, your training stress balance number, to make decisions in and around rest and recovery and training. We've got a hot property interview with Lisa Roberts, American triathlete who recently got onto the podium at Challenge Roth, having quite a consistent season and working with the Tri-Sutto group. So wonderful interview. Such a lovely, lovely lady and really doing some great things, especially with her own coaching and also in youth triathlon as well. So Lisa Roberts is on the show. And we're going to catch up with Jeremy Davis, who is running the next incarnation of the Tough Man Tri after their New York Championship race. It's happening on the 30th of September in South Carolina. So Jeremy's going to tell us a little bit more about that event.
Awesome.
So let's go to Workout of the Week. So we've talked in the past about the metrics within Training Peaks, chronic training load, acute training load, and training stress balance. So within your performance manager chart where these particular metrics actually sit, I'm going to talk a little bit about the TSB or how fresh or how fatigued you are. So when discussing training stress balance, I want to actually just bring us back to understanding what it means in real terms. So it's really a proxy for form, or in other words, freshness, i.e. are you very fresh or are you fatigued? So we're talking a little bit to do with your race readiness. So when we talk about TSB, we're talking about, you know, are you ready to perform on the day, or are you actually going to be too fatigued? So within your performance manager chart, there's a yellow line that represents TSB. Now, when the TSB line falls and produces a negative TSB number on the performance manager chart, then that would indicate that your current training is actually more stressful than your current fitness levels. So as an athlete, you're becoming less fresh. So you're actually losing some ability to perform because you're fatigued. Now, if the line...
However, that's expected, right?
Yes, it's
part
yeah.
Part of training.
Absolutely. We want that to actually happen. So what I'm going to provide here is a little bit of context around the negative numbers and what kind of sort of range is optimal and what kind of range is maybe too much, so that when we're looking at our TSB numbers when they become negative, you know, as a general guideline, what kind of ranges should we be working in to create enough stress to be fit? And when do we get into risky ranges of TSB numbers becoming too negative, where illness or injury may crop up?
Okay.
So we know that equally, if we undertrain a little bit, the TSB number will start to rise and will be becoming a little bit more fresh. So when the TSB number is actually positive, an athlete is on form. So they're actually ready to perform with their current level of fitness that they actually have. So what I'm going to talk about here is when the TSB number is negative, what should we actually be looking for to optimize enough training stress for it to be beneficial? And when we might be actually entering states of fatigue that could cause overreaching or overtraining. So on your performance manager chart, there's actually a zero point. So you'll see it as a dotted yellow line across your PMC chart, your performance manager chart. And that's the balance point for TSB. Above that dotted line, the TSB number becomes positive, so you're actually fresh. And below it, it becomes negative, so you're not fresh. So the more positive or higher than zero the fresher the athlete is, and the more negative, the more tired they are. So let's focus a little bit on some potential ranges that we may want to operate in order to build fitness. If you've got and remember, you must have an accurate and up-to-date functional threshold power or pace number in your Training Peaks account, so that all TSS numbers, training stress numbers, are calculated correctly, because the performance manager chart needs to have up-to-date and correct TSS numbers in it for it to calculate chronic training load, acute training load, and obviously your training stress balance. Now, if you start to see in your performance manager chart a training stress balance number that is minus 30 or more negative than that, I call that the high risk zone. And if you spend too much time at a TSB value of minus 30 or more, you'll actually be creating high levels of fatigue and you're flirting with extreme overreaching. That could become overtraining if you spend too many days at that particular negative TSB number.
So is that a score that you would get after each session, Bev?
Yeah. So basically all your TSS numbers that are imported into Training Peaks based on your heart rate, or say your run and bike workouts, they will accumulate over time to indicate your chronic training load. And then in a more recent window, you'll be looking at your acute training, what you're doing most recently. And when you compare those two together, if training is more stressful than our current fitness level, then our TSB, our training stress balance number, will become negative. But it's how negative, okay? So in general terms, for most athletes, and this, and I'll put a caveat around this, that some athletes can tolerate being fatigued for longer and being more fatigued for longer. So it is very individual. But in general terms, if your TSB becomes minus 30 or more, then you're actually starting to reach a very high level of fatigue that you may not want to exist in that state for a long period of time because of the risk of illness or injury.
Is an athlete, if they're more experienced or they're at a higher ability level, are they more likely to be able to sustain a higher level of fatigue, or is it actually quite individual, do you think?
Well, look, it is very individual. I do think that experience does help a lot, because the more durable you are as an athlete comes from many years of training. And it is something to actually look at as an individual. Now, you may go back and revisit your performance manager chart, and you might see some periods where you were more than minus 30 for, you know, a number of days. What you want to ask yourself is what happened in and around that period? Because sometimes people have two or three illnesses during a season of training. And it's really good to actually go back and see what your TSB number was at that particular time. Was there a period where it was very negative in and around that period of illness or injury? And you may actually start to see some trends occur. It's not uncommon for athletes when they revisit a season and they may have had a period of persistent injury or illness, that they can correlate their TSB number and see that what their personal breaking point, for want of a better description, is, or tipping point might be. And then in the future, they may avoid going that negative for that long, because you'll actually start to see what your personal ability level is in terms of tolerating fatigue. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense, yeah.
Okay. But we do want to have a negative TSB number in order to create fitness. So a negative TSB number actually represents a period of hard training. And if you do see numbers for most athletes, and as I say, as a generalization, if you start to go past minus 30, it's going to be a time to actually indicate to start to reduce the training load a little bit, so that you start to see the TSB number rise again, indicating a move towards more freshness. Because if you stay too long in minus 30 or even deeper than that, you are in a high risk zone. And so it's really time to address that and start to reduce the training load, so that you can see your TSB start to rise again and move back towards zero. So what is a potentially an optimal training zone for your TSB? Well, I think it's basically somewhere between minus 10 to around about minus 30. This is typically when the most effective training actually occurs. So we can actually apply a training stress that starts to see our TSB number become negative and sit within maybe minus 10 to minus 30 is a nice range to actually operate in when we're in an overload phase of our training. If your TSB actually starts to get less than minus 10 and get closer to zero or even become positive, you don't want to spend too much training time here if you're trying to build fitness, because in that particular range, the stress is probably not sufficient enough to create overload. You'd want to probably be in a minus 10 to positive 5 range in your performance manager chart during a rest period or a recovery week, or potentially when you start to tapering for an A priority race. So TSB numbers in that particular range, minus 10 to minus positive 5, is, as I say, in a rest or recovery period. And if you're trying to create fitness, I would suggest working in a TSB range of somewhere between minus 10 to minus 30. So that's how you can actually start to use TSB as an indicator of the optimal amount of training stress in order to build fitness, when you might be in a higher risk fatigue state, and also when you want to reduce that fatigue so that you're actually in a period where the body's actually starting to rejuvenate and become a little bit fresher so that you can move on to your next block of training.
See, I think this is awesome, Bevan, because intuitively you kind of know when you're tired and when you're ready to have a break a lot of the time, right?
Yep.
And it may or may not be in your schedule to have it, but if your TSB number reflects that, in fact, you're kind of dipping a little bit too deep into the negatives,
yep,
then that'll just give you further kind of indication to actually, even if it's not scheduled to have a download week or a couple of easy days, I think I'm going to benefit from it. But the opposite must be true as well, right? If you're not as fatigued as what your training would have predicted, then potentially you could kind of push a little bit further and try and gain more fitness at that time, do you reckon?
Absolutely. Yeah, look, absolutely. Look, one of the things that I'm experiencing of late is the introduction of data to a lot of people's programs has been hugely beneficial. But remember that data doesn't actually do the work for us. We do the work. It's not data that turns the pedals or puts the running shoes on. So we need to understand that it's there as a companion to how we're feeling. And look, if we can look historically at some of the information and work out, did it align with our perceived rate of exertion, how we felt on any particular day, our mood, our levels of fatigue, then we start to gain a little bit more confidence if it correlates quite nicely with what we're truly experiencing as a human being. But I do find that it has helped me a lot where athletes are concerned, when they buy into the concept of training stress score and how it can be applied and used in this fashion, like I said, with chronic training load, acute training load, training stress balance, because it's really difficult in a lot of times to convince an athlete to rest. However, it's been easier for people who actually convert to using data, because this is a fairly robust way to measure fatigue and freshness. And if you're undecided about taking a day off or not, but your TSB is actually saying, yes, you should, then that decision becomes a hell of a lot easier for those athletes who typically make the mistake of ignoring all the physical signs of fatigue and pushing on with training anyway, and then getting ill, getting injured, and underperforming. So you're right. Yes, if you have a confidence in Training Peaks and their methodology, then this goes a long way to help it making you really good informed decisions about when to train and when not to train and how hard to train.
Yeah, I think that's cool. Like, even it's related to that, having like someone else make the decision for you, or something else making the decision for you.
Yeah.
It's like when you follow a good training program, which is what I'm experiencing right now, is that I don't decide how far I run, how to run, when to have a day off. The training program does it for you. And if you're experienced enough to appreciate how the amount of running you do, or the toll that it can take on your body, then you don't undervalue the rest. Whereas if I was just doing what I randomly do, which is pretty much what I, you know, most of the time I don't follow a program, it's too easy for me to get up and go, could have a rest day, now I'll go and do something.
Yeah, definitely. So there's some structure to what you're doing, and there's some progressive overload and some planned recovery.
Yeah.
And look, this will help a lot of people who I'm sure are probably trying to understand the performance manager chart without the aid of a coach. And you will find what trends work best for you as an individual, because these numerical ranges I've described here will work for most athletes, but there are some outliers for whom these zones are either too high or too low. So adjustments should be made based on experience. And so that's why it is good to review at the end of the season. If you have got a robust amount of data that you believe is relatively accurate, to look at your performance manager chart and see whether there were any incidences of the TSB number becoming really negative and you getting sick or injured. And equally so, when your best performances came, was the TSB number positive, and what was that positive number, so that you know that if you're trying to taper for a race, that maybe you optimally work at a positive TSB number of X and your performance is strongest when you're in and around that particular level of freshness. So it is still individualized, definitely.
And also, Bev, the effect of the kind of other factors would play into it, right, with regards to heart rate and stuff. So if you've got a fairly negative TSB score on a training load, which maybe the previous year you had the similar training load but a different TSB score, then potentially that's talking more, or that's reflecting more other lifestyle contributors to, say, a lack of sleep.
That's actually what I, you know, it's part of the information that an athlete actually gathers, and so it's not definitive. You know, as I say, the data doesn't race for us. It just helps us make decisions, and it's part of the science side of coaching, but there has to come into play the art side. And the art side, training peaks in the performance manager chart doesn't take into consideration. It doesn't know if we've had poor nutrition or bad sleep or an argument with our partner or stress at work or whatever it is. So we always have to make sure that we take into account how we're truly feeling versus what the data is actually telling us. So that becomes a little bit of experience for the athlete. But then also having a smart coach who understands this as well is a really good idea. So, you've got to take both of those things into account, definitely, when you're making decisions in and around training and racing.
Cool.
All right. So that's my workout of the week.
I love it, Bevan. And do you know what else I'm loving is being in a country where the population is big enough to sustain things like a Marks & Spencer's Simply Food at a service station stop where you get off on the M4. I do. You've just got this amazing array of choices that extend beyond muesli bars and jerky when you kind of get off for a coffee, right? So
we love it.
Driving.
Yeah. The Marks and Spencers.
It's brilliant. And it's really reasonable too. Like the vegetarian got a beetroot, goat's cheese and lentil kind of salad type number, and I got these rice paper wraps with turmeric chicken in them, and then we got these cut up vegetables, and there was also this smashed edamame salad and these hard boiled eggs with goat's cheese, like all for a buck each or a couple of bucks each. And it's phenomenal just the choices that are available to people over here.
Yeah, well, definitely. Marks and Spencer's, in terms of the service station stop-offs in the UK, is probably one of the things that, and I kid you not, that Chris and I bemoan the most, and we wish it was everywhere around the world, because their food options, you think of us, and no disrespect to Australians here, but when we did our Noosa training camp and we called into the service station on the way up to Noosa, and our I think Chris went and got a Or did you get a chicken burger from Burger King and just ate the chicken out of the middle of it? And Chris was eating the protein out of a sandwich, you know, throwing everything else away. But there was nothing of real good value to be able to choose. Whereas you walk into a Marks and Spencer in the UK at one of the service stations, you're like, I could eat here all week.
I know. It's just crazy. And and it is so cheap. Oh, I've got to say, though, Spain, the absolute opposite is true in terms of just availability. Like breakfast, for example, the most popular breakfast was tostada with either marmalade, avocado, or this beautiful tomato. That's basically pureed tomatoes with like olive oil and salt and pepper. And I mean, it was delicious, but to start your day after a long run with half a baguette with butter and marmalade, whilst delicious, pretty much puts your appetite in a spin later on the day. But you do it because you're on holiday.
Yeah. And when in Spain.
Exactly. When in Spain. But it just makes you appreciate what there is available in other areas, I think. Yeah. And when people talk about how it can be really difficult, you kind of think, yeah, actually, for some people, it can be challenging. However, those in the UK, no excuses.
No excuses at all. I know exactly what you're talking about, and they do a fantastic job of it. So that actually eating in the UK is quite easy.
I know. This is what makes traveling so important for me in my professional development.
Well, you should just continue on. I just think you should just backpack on the shoulder. You're off. I'm sending you around the world. Okay, so we better catch up with Lisa. I had a wonderful time doing this interview. She's such a lovely, lovely lady. And in the interview, I actually didn't know at the time, but Lisa Roberts had spent some time living in Hamilton in New Zealand. But it was great to catch up with her, and she's doing great things. So here's Lisa Roberts.
Right. So on today's Hot Property interview, we have recent third place Challenge Roth finisher, Lisa Roberts. Good evening, Lisa.
Hello. How are you?
It's 5:30 in the morning here in New Zealand. I've just had my first coffee.
Oh. That's how committed. Oh, just the first one.
That's how committed I am to podcasting and to capture your interview. I'll get up at any time of the day to have a chat to you.
Oh my God. Okay, now I really need to say something profound. I'm under pressure.
Firstly, I harp on about Netflix documentary and binge watching. Tell me, is House of Cards one of your favorite ever Netflix series? Talk to me.
It is, surprisingly. Although I do have to say, what's running a close second is The Great British Baking Show.
Oh, no, stop. My partner, affectionately known as sound engineer Chris, who does all the hard work behind the scenes, is addicted to The Great British Bake Off. She is English. We sit down and watch that. The kids got us into it. They absolutely love it. The fact that you're now her favorite professional triathlete in the world.
There we go. Done. My work here is done.
How did you get into the, let's forget triathlon, how did you get into The Great British Bake Off?
It came about with, I was recovering from a stress fracture earlier this year or through the winter. And so when I was actually finally able to get the go-ahead to ride my bike, I was stuck inside on the trainer. And so therefore, I went through many a Netflix show and just happened across it, probably because I was really hungry one day when I was riding my bike, and that was it. I was hooked after that. So every time I got on the trainer, I watched The Great British Baking Show.
That's fantastic. Most people, they it's really interesting when you talk about what do you distract yourself with on the trainer. You know, some people have to watch something really that they can't, don't invest a lot of mental energy in, or, you know, maybe it's a comedy or something like that, but you just like to see massive cakes being baked.
How can you go wrong?
And the only thing you think is, the moment I get off the trainer, I'm gonna have something to eat.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so stress fracture at the beginning of the year. Is that one of the reasons that drove you towards making that late decision to do Roth? Because it was a pretty late decision for someone who prides herself on being a real long-term planner.
Yes. It was. And that was my first marathon that I had run since Kona of last year. It was shortly, about a month after Kona, is when I got the stress fracture. And so that was my, by far, not even just the marathon, just by far my longest run that I had done since October the previous year. And so we were kind of playing it by ear. Now, I also, in that time, had come from Arizona over to Switzerland, St. Moritz, to train with the Brett Sutton and his crew here. So we were also playing it by ear a little bit to see how I adjusted just with jet lag and with the altitude. So I was entered, and then probably about 5 days before the race, I got the thumbs up to go.
Wow. Is that the first major injury in your career?
It is. And coming from a running background, of which I've done now for 25 years, I guess I would consider myself a legitimate runner, distance runner. That was the first major injury that I've ever had. So knock on wood somewhere, touch wood somewhere. That's the only one I have.
Yeah. And also the move to being coached by Brett and under Tri Sutto, is that a more recent move for you?
It is. Yeah, that also happened at the end of the year. Almost right about the same time, unfortunately, to start with a new coach and then go, oh, okay, great. I have a broken foot. Let's deal with that now. I think it was time for a change. I've had some excellent coaches along the way. I thought of myself as being, personally being resilient enough, I think, to handle the load and the type of training that he does. And was really looking forward to just taking that next step and just kind of an extra added, you know, push, if you will.
Okay. So up until that particular period, you were based in the US and Tucson. Was that where your training base was?
Yes. Yeah. And that's where my home is. And that's where I'm at most of the time, unless I'm gallivanting about racing or training. Yes. Okay.
So how big a change for you was it in picking up with Trisato and working under Brett? You know, obviously long periods spent over in training bases like Switzerland and so forth. And what was some of the major changes that occurred in your approach? Because obviously Roth was a fantastic result for you, an incredibly great run split, but you're not you're well known for that. But what were some of the significant changes in changing that environment from the US to working under Brett?
I think, first of all, just having the oversight almost constantly, not specifically in the pool, constant oversight, but even on some of the other biker run sessions, he's out there watching and providing some feedback. That was a pretty major change from what I'd been used to. And just his overall approach with regard to training volume and frequency. I went from maybe having one or two sessions a day to, you know, three, sometimes maybe four sessions a day under Brett. And so that took a little bit of getting used to, not just from the volume aspect, but I mean, here we go again. Trying to figure out what in the world can I eat in between these these sessions so that I'm not like, you know, so you're not, you know, sick during sessions. So that took quite a bit of adjusting too as well.
Okay. Coming from a running background, you know, you decided to turn pro. There's many athletes out there on the circuit that grew up in the States and were, you know, runners, track runners and the like, cross country. That's mm-hmm. your background. What about swimming? Is it don't worry, the microphone picked up that sigh. Okay, so you're about
DM to technology.
No, don't worry. 10,000 listeners just went, we know what she's on about. So talk to me about how you got into the swimming portion of triathlon and what has been your progression, because I think a lot of people are particularly fascinated with Sato's approach to swimming, and we can talk mm-hmm. whether you've changed your technique in moving to Brett, but how did it first start?
Oh, the swim, the bane of my existence. I came about swimming only through triathlon. I grew up in pretty small, very rural town in Illinois, which is kind of in the center of the states. And swimming was not part of any sort of sports curriculum. It was always, you know, football, baseball, soccer, basketball, things like that. I mean, I don't even think I really even saw a lap pool until I got to college. And even then, when I was running in college, the lap pool was the punishment, because that meant that you were probably injured in some way and you couldn't run. So you got sent to the pool to water jog. So growing up, really, swimming was just revolved around getting a good tan and working on my cannonballs and jackknives and whatnot in the pool and a good back dive. And that was about it. And so, it was only through triathlon and when a friend of mine in graduate school had suggested that maybe I give it a shot because I'd been done now running competitively collegiately through NCAA, and so didn't have any of that eligibility left and was kind of looking around for something else because I was only 21 or 22 years old, and I thought, this can't be it. You know, I can't be done competing now. And so when she suggested a triathlon, I went, okay. So I went and bought a used road bike, slapped some aero bars on it and thought, well, that's considered aero. And then just showed up at the pool and started swimming and looking around at what other people were doing, and had a few really good friends who had done triathlon in the past who offered me a lot of help, very good swimmers, open water swimmers as well. And so at least got me kind of started in the right direction. And then I eventually joined with a master's swim group in Tucson to get a bit more formal and structured swimming and swimming in with more people and getting pushed a little bit more. It was fairly organic, if you will. And for many years, when I first started triathlon, never once did I have a thought that I would do it professionally at all. It was just, to me, it was something that was giving me, you know, many more years of being able to push myself and compete some more. And I was probably taking it pretty casually. You know, I thought, well, I probably need to go swim a couple days a week. So I went and swam a couple days a week and didn't get a whole lot into, you know, technique or anything. I just thought I needed to get some yards in. And so that's what I did. And so I got a little bit of a boost, obviously, just from doing that. You know, I got a little bit faster and a little bit faster and then started to get a bit more specific. Now I was starting to get more into triathlon and talking to more people and learning a little bit more, reading about a lot more about it and thinking, oh, I should probably, like, maybe I should really kind of, you know, get into this a little bit more. So got a fair bit more into learning some technique. Now, whether or not, you know, I think that's good or bad, because I am very much so a planner. And, you know, once I get into something, I really dive into it. And then, you know, I can get into the minutiae of things, which I think a lot of times for swimming might not be the best approach, because it just basically makes you like a stiff as a board in there. So.
I overthink it.
Yeah.
You worked a bit with, is it Tim at Magnolia Masters? Yes, that's right. Okay. And he's in the Woodlands, isn't he, in Texas?
Yes, he is. Yeah, so I worked with Tim for a couple years and spent some time over there a couple weeks at a time swimming with him and his group, and found another, you know, that was sort of another jump that I had in my swim fitness and a different approach to it as well. You know, I've noticed over the years, because I think I've talked to and worked with so many different people in the swimming, because it's, you know, it's one of those things you just sort of feel like you're standing in the middle of an open field shouting, you know, please somebody help me with my swimming.
Could somebody give me that magic formula, please? I don't seem to have arrived at it just yet.
Exactly. So he took another approach, and I, you know, saw another good increase in my swimming, and then really started to get into it some more. And I've also worked with Jerry Rodriguez over in Santa Monica with the Tower 26 group, which again was another great focus in the open water swimming aspect with their weekly workouts that they have out there in the Pacific. Yep. So all of these things, you know, I've kind of been picking up bits and pieces. And then, you know, Brett has also now offered another piece, which is, you know, even above and beyond, it adds to, I think, a lot of what I've already learned. And it's also added a couple new things in there with it as well. And, his approach, particularly with people who, you know, adult onset swimmers, like most of us are, is to really, you got to get the yardage in there, and however you can get the yardage in. You know, if you're miserable and you end up, you know, getting out of the pool early because you're just so miserable being in there and you just don't want to do it, that's not going to get you anywhere. So how can we get you
back
to actually enjoy this?
How can we get you back in the pool? Because he's a great believer in, if you use a few of the swim toys to get you back in the pool, then use them. And also a little bit more, how should I say, not so worried about what happens above the water, but let's get work done underneath the water.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you would have had like three different real approaches to swimming. I think Tim's known for his particular ethos in Magnolia. Jerry's got his as well. But then obviously you feel that you're making another step forward under Sutter's tutelage.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, you know, a lot of that's coming from a big volume approach to it. To swimming. And so, you know, just by default, you know, you get a heck of a lot stronger now. And, you know, here we go. I'll go ahead and make the podcast explicit, because the first thing that he said to me when he saw me swim, when I came here to Switzerland, was, you know, he saw me panicking, first of all, to try to hold on to the feet of my lane mates. And, you know, obviously the stroke just goes to shit at that point. And so, you know, he pulled me out and he basically said, look, you know, your swim is shit. It's always going to be shit.
So, thanks, Brett.
Yeah. Okay. What you need to do is just accept it. You know, go home, write it on a piece of paper, you know, introduce yourself to people as, hi, my name is Lisa, my swim is shit. And just, you know, just own it. And then let's do what we can. Let's get you as fit as we can in the water, so that you can go and you can bike and run, so you're not so completely tanked out from trying to swim so hard that it's affecting your bike and your run. Because obviously, you know, we're dealing with triathlon here. So and we've got, you know, two more disciplines to hit after we get out of that water. So that's been the approach, and, you know, to a certain extent, you know, somewhat refreshing, and it's a little bit more motivation to get in there and go, okay, yeah, right, it is, it's kind of shit.
But I'm going to get fit.
Here we go.
Yeah. It's shit, you know. But I'm going to get fit.
Yeah.
So, okay, so give the listeners the glory details. How many yards or meters are you going to swim this week?
Oh, it'll probably be, gosh, I don't even like to add it up anymore because that just totally freaks me out. It will be probably close to 30K okay. By the end of the week, I believe.
Okay.
So I haven't added it up yet, but it's been as much as I had a very long stint there, especially with the stress fracture.
Yep.
Where I was in the pool three times a day, almost every day a week, and that was, I was about 50 to 55K a week for, I don't know, it was a good 8 to 10 weeks. Yeah, I was not a happy person.
No, I don't think anyone would be. You've got no friends, no. There's no one to talk to.
No.
Okay, well, let's talk this year. So you come off the back of a stress fracture. You know, for you as a long-distance triathlete and someone who probably recognizes that the iron distance is probably your more competitive distance than 70.3, am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I think you're right in saying that, yes.
Okay, so once you get into long-distance triathlon, the fixation with Kona, is that something that burns deep in you?
Boy, you know what? It comes and it goes. I had... This year, obviously, with the stress fracture, I just thought, you know, I could make a really good run and get the points and qualify. But, you know, to condense your season, you know, that much coming off an injury and try to jam in a bunch of races to get points just did not light a fire in my belly whatsoever. So this year I just kind of backed off and went, let's get healthy, let's get fit, let's, you know, go choose some races to do that really excite me. And then let's see what, you know, happens for next year. And it's, you know, as I get older, I won't say how old I am, but or you can ask. But
I would never do that, Lisa. I would never do that. I'm a consummate professional. I haven't asked your weight either.
No.
Although the Great British...
That I'll lie about all day long.
So. Especially with someone who's fixated on the Great British Bake Off. But you're not particularly big. I can tell the listeners that.
No, I don't think I am. But you know, it's one of those things. That's kind of, you know, obviously it's the pinnacle. It's the pinnacle race of the thing. Now, whether or not I think that race course particularly suits me, again, it all boils down to that darn swim. And if you go out there on a bad day and you've got, you know, pretty good currents and pretty good swell, you know, I'm way off the back. And so, is that something that I really want to, you know, put myself into? Or am I best served, you know, going around doing races that might suit my strengths better? So I waver between the two. I love to go because it's Kona, for one. But in other ways, I hate to go because it's Kona.
Yeah. Okay, well, and also, you know, from your skill set as well, you know, late to swimming in triathlon, but you've picked up biking particularly well. I mean, obviously with the running background, but you are recognized as being a really strong biker. Is that because of your nickname Reese's Pieces and all your European cycling tours? Should I have introduced you as Reese's Pieces?
Yeah, sure, you can do that. Yes, I did get that nickname many years ago from some friends of mine in Tucson, and that one has stuck, which is fine. And yes, maybe it's been 4 or 5 years now that I've been lucky enough to be a tour guide for some of the European cycling tours that Riley Cycling does, and just getting that exposure to all these different climbs, particularly the ones in France. A few here in Switzerland and in Italy. I think that's really kind of bumped up my cycling. I think it's cycling itself is a much easier progression for somebody from a running background. And I think in lots of ways has supplemented and really helped my running because now I'm running less miles in a week than I did when I was in college by far. But I'm running just as fast, if not faster. And I think cycling complements running quite well. So I think that was an easy transition for me to make. I've done some bike racing as well, usually I'll throw myself into a couple of races really early in the year in Arizona. We can do bike races. You know, we start those in February and March. So I get a couple good races in really early season, and I continue to have fun with that as well.
Well, it hasn't hurt your running at all by any stretch. So for the listeners, you know, you are fairly regularly under the 8-hour mark. And I'll tell you this for free, and I know that Laura Siddell, who contributes to our podcast, I know that Sid was crapping herself at Jelland Roth. Now that new...
I got a stern talking to her from her after the race. Don't ever do that again.
Well, that new run course, I mean, it's not fast. It's definitely different from, you know, previous years. Far more undulation and a few more tight corners and the like. But a 2:56 on that course, were you particularly pleased with your performance at Roth this year? And talk to me, did you love the environment?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I was over the moon with my performance at that race. I really, you know, I kind of went into it, you know, with 5 days of, you know, basically mental preparation for it. I didn't really, which I think actually really played into my favor. I didn't have time to kind of stress over things and over plan and overthink things. I just basically had to get my stuff together and get over there to go race. And so I had in the back of my head, obviously I know a lot of people go under 9 hours at Roth, and I thought, boy, that would be great. I'd love to go under 9 hours now that I've been given this opportunity to go race. And you know, never really thought, I mean, I've been, I don't want to say, I guess lucky enough. I don't know. I've done the training obviously, so I can't really say it's all luck, but I'm pretty consistently at or under 3 hours for all the marathons that I do, regardless sometimes of how hard the run course is. And, I'm really enjoying that consistency with it. And so to be able to, you know, to pull out a 2:56 marathon, being the first marathon back after a stress fracture, and my longest run, I think my longest run up until Roth was maybe 25K. And so it wasn't, obviously I knew I could do the distance, but there's always that you hit that 25K mark in the race and you go, all right, I'm venturing into the great unknown here. Let's see how this goes. And so I was really thrilled to just see that, you know, my foot held up well, everything worked the way that, you know, I remember it working. So I was thrilled with that. I was thrilled with the, you know, sub 9 hour performance, and then to get a podium on top of it, I was absolutely over the moon. And to be in that kind of environment and experience that at a really good race just like makes everything, you know, exponentially, you know, even greater than what it already is. So,
well, you've got a great start back after a stress fracture. Now, I noticed on your race schedule, you've got penciled in Embrun Man.
Ah, yes. That one's now firmly in ink.
Wow. So, and that's only, what, 1 week away? Or how long away is Embrun Man?
Yes, 6 days. So it's August 15th. So it's on a Tuesday.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, we talked to Carrie Lester not long after she did it last year, and the pain and scars were still pretty deep in her. So for the listeners that don't know, describe Embrun Man and what your expectations for the race of that difficulty are. I know it's to win.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I would love to at that race. Oh man, would that be, I mean, first of all, I always enjoy racing in France. I've always had a really good time racing at Ironman France and Nice as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, a 2:54 marathon and Ironman Nice in 2015, I'd be pretty happy racing Nice too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I love to, I mean, they just love, you know, triathlon and sport there. I mean, it's, as do, you know, a lot of the countries here in Europe that I enjoy racing in as well. And so that one, I'm approaching that one a little bit in the same, it's so hard and so, you know, much more difficult than anything that I have done before. And I've done the Alpe d'Huez triathlon a couple of times, but this is obviously twice as long. So we're looking at, you know, basically a full distance race. And I would consider it, you know, at least twice as hard, if not more. It has the Col d'Izoard is the main climb on the bike. I think there is somewhere in the neighborhood of, is it about 12,000 feet of elevation gain. Yeah, over that bike ride. It's a 188K bike. It can get hot, and I think it will again this year. And it's got a couple other little nasty descents and climbs after the Izzard that you really have to be, you know, on your toes with. So after you've completely smashed yourself for a few hours climbing that baby, you have to, you know, regroup and make sure you don't, you know, fall over yourself coming down some of the other descents. Yeah, they start the race in the dark, and so it starts about 6 a.m., and you have to follow candlelight, essentially, yeah. from boats and kayaks to find your way through the swim until the sun comes up. Yeah.
Well, as I say, I just remember laughing along with Carrie when she was recounting it, and the run, you know, once your legs have been absolutely smashed a bit by the bike, it's not an easy finish to the day. But the wonderful thing about that race is, you know, as an independent race, not WTC owned, not Challenge owned, there's still great prize money up for grabs. You know, there's a wonderful opportunity. And like you say, you know, when if there's no eye on Kona this year, it's a really big chance to go off there and do some races that are a little bit different, but can still potentially earn a great payday.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly the plan. And yeah, it's just I don't really necessarily have, I mean, I'm going in fully prepared and fully ready. But I'm keeping some expectations because I don't really know. I mean, I'm not really sure if I can set expectations on a course like that.
Yeah.
I think there's so many more things that could go wrong than on a normal Ironman course that you just kind of have to just, you know, go into it, race smart, and, you know, go with what the day gives you.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Now, you know, as a pro out there, we talk about making money. You know, obviously we've got to win some races or do very well in them to start to get some money coming in. But you've also had the support of Team Timex, and you've been with them for an extended period of time now, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, this is my fourth year with the Timex team. Yeah, I'm super thrilled. And I really do attribute a lot of, I kind of started to have my breakthrough races about the same time that I got onto the team. And when I first started racing professionally back in 2009, I believe, I was at that exact same time in my brilliance, also decided to quit my job and start my own small landscape design company at the same time. Now, I don't, you know, for all the listeners out there, don't ever do that. Don't decide to become a professional triathlete and start a business at the same time. So that was a really stupid decision. I mean, not necessarily stupid, but it was a very difficult decision that I made. And so I struggled for the first couple of years, obviously just trying to make ends meet somehow. So while I was racing professionally, I wouldn't necessarily say that I was treating it as professionally as I should have. And then when I finally got on to the Timex team, that took a lot of load off my back as far as just trying to secure sponsorships. And now I have the support of a team behind me who is basically saying, you know, look, we'll help you however we can, so that you can have the time to train and race and, support us as well and promote us as well. And so that was a huge relief for me. And then at almost the exact same time, I started hitting the podiums on a lot of the Ironman races that I was doing. And I don't think that was necessarily a fluke or just sort of, you know, happened to be the timing. I think a lot of that had to do with a lot of pressure being taken off of me.
Yeah.
So I could focus on training.
Yeah, and you see the advent of more and more teams entering the market, and Team Timex doesn't have quite the same size profile, but it's sort of offering the same thing, isn't it? It brings together a whole bunch of different product sponsors, some support that goes in behind that. And when you're a newer pro trying to go out and find an individual bike sponsor or, you know, gear sponsor or nutritional order, maybe it literally just takes care of all that for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because really, I mean, you know, these companies aren't knocking on your door, you know, saying, hey, we'd love to sponsor you, you know, here's some stuff or here's some money or here's whatever.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, and it takes, you know, sometimes it takes years to finally find, you know, the correct people to talk to, develop a relationship, and you know, then only then you might be lucky enough to, you know, to get in for sponsorship. So
yeah,
it's not an easy process.
And just so that people know, in the Tucson area, if they need landscape design, who do they call?
Yes. They can call me. You know,
Tucson.
Can you message on Facebook?
The Tucson and surrounding regions, is how far will we
reach? Absolutely. Well, here I will reach. I reach as far as New Zealand now.
Do you?
So I did for now. My first Ironman I did in 2005 was Ironman New Zealand.
Okay.
And then had great aspirations because I was I had recently graduated with my master's degree in landscape architecture. Traveled around the country after the race. Really wanted to see if there was a way that I could potentially get a job to work there because I love New Zealand. And I was successful in getting that. So I lived for a little over a year in Hamilton. So a little ways away from
hold
you.
Hold on. Where's this in my research? I didn't know that.
Yes, I have a big shout out to my Hamilton peeps over there as well. I love them all, and I still talk to them and see them quite regularly.
Okay.
But yes, I have a great love for New Zealand.
Okay, so about a global reach in terms of landscape design.
Yes. So I work there as a landscape architect.
Perfect.
Okay,
so wow. for all the people, the triathlon enthusiasts who listen to our podcast, should you need the garden sorted, talk to Lisa.
There we go. Yes, perfect.
Talk to me about coaching. You're a coach with Endurance Corner. Now, that's not an easy gig to get to work under the Endurance Corner, Britain. They're actually pretty picky, and they've got a real brains trust, Alan Cousins. I follow a lot of his work really, really closely. But when did you start coaching? And I see you also do work with XL Tri Coaching and work with the kids as well. So it seems to be something you really enjoy.
I do. I really enjoy it. I've always liked, you know, teaching people, if you will, and coaching all along the way. And I mean, my mother was a teacher as well, so I think a little bit of that rubbed off on me. And I've gotten to know Justin Dare and Marilyn and Sue and Alan and a bunch of the folks from Endurance Corner. Over the years, they have a couple Tucson camps.
They've got
one that's coming up here in August and another one in February. And just kind of started off coming in as sort of the local, you know, pro. And I would come and, you know, help and sort of guide on some of the, you know, bike rides and chat with people and or host a, you know, a run session at the track or something. And, you know, it kind of gave me because I was telling them that I was thinking about getting into coaching and I really wanted to see a little bit more. I respect all of them in that group as coaches and wanted to get a little bit more insight into and experience into working with, you know, people and a group of people and how does that all work. And so helped them out over a couple of years and then, yeah, was lucky enough to have them ask me if I wanted to come on board as a coach just last year. So it's been really recent, and I'm really enjoying it. I've got three athletes at this point, which, you know, it's probably five is about my max with being able to handle, you know, training load and attribute enough time to the athletes that I think that they need. But, yeah, I'm really enjoying it quite a bit. So.
Okay. So that's something that you see yourself doing after the sport is finished, or what's your position?
Absolutely. Yeah, I do. And the more that I've gotten into it, the more I've enjoyed it more. And I do think that it's something that I'll expand upon after I'm done competing professionally, for sure. And to add on to that, you know, helping out with XL Tri, which is just it's a local youth triathlon group in Tucson, working with those little kids. Are you kidding me? That's I love it. Some of the random things that these kids say during these events. I don't know if you've ever worked with kids, but it's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Well, wait till you turn around to sit them and say if they turn up with an injury that they're going to swim three times a week, you're going to knock out 55 Ks. Let's see what they say to you then.
Yeah, exactly. The glazed look, yeah.
Okay, so Embra Man's on the agenda. I mean, you've raced Alpe d'Huez. You got third in Alpe d'Huez this year as well. What's the end of the year looking like, and what is the future goals, big goals for Lisa?
Yeah, well, the end of the year, I will eventually return to the States. I've been here now in Switzerland since mid-June. I'll return to the States in September again, and probably in pretty short order, next up on the list for Ironmans will probably be Ironman Louisville. That will obviously start to acquire points for next year's Kona, and we'll see. Yeah,
so again, giving yourself every chance to try and get the points together for Kona.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be a focus on that, but I'm still debating on whether or not I make this, you know, a hard and fast, you know, got to get Kona points. I'll definitely set myself up race wise to put myself in a good position to qualify for Kona if I want to do that. But going into next year, really finding I would like to, and I think I will make a return to Ironman New Zealand because I'm really enjoying doing the races that are very close to me, and Ironman New Zealand is definitely one of them. So New Zealand could be on the books for next year.
Oh, well, there you go. Imagine a little running battle with Jocelyn McCauley, you know, both three-hour and sub-three-hour runners. Wouldn't that be interesting?
That would be very interesting.
Well, I know Jocelyn listens to our podcast, so she's now gone and ticked the box. Watch out for Roberts on the start list.
That's right, Jocelyn. Yes, I know Jocelyn pretty well. So beware, Jocelyn, I'm coming.
Yes. Okay. Well, if we can remain injury-free, the stress fracture is something that's in the history for you now. We wish you all the best with the rest of the season. Wonderful to see such a fantastic result for you at Challenge Roth. And we do hope to see you in on the start line here at Ironman New Zealand next year.
Absolutely. I'll let you guys know when I'm coming.
She seemed like such a lovely girl.
Yeah, cool. She, exactly. After the interview, she emailed me straight away a photo of her swimming, of a shot of her swimming in Hamilton somewhere. I think she might have even had a Kiwi bathing cap on or something like that. But it was hilarious. It was hilarious. And hopefully she'll be coming back for New Zealand Ironman in 2018. So it'd be really good to meet her there. And she'll be going head-to-head with Sid and Jocelyn McCauley, who actually Jocelyn won Ironman 70.3 Vichy in France recently as well. So she'd be happy to get up on the top step of the podium. So it'd be great to have all those girls back in New Zealand for New Zealand Ironman next year.
Oh, look, totally. Hey, now, kind of not at all related, at Doha Airport, have you been?
No.
Oh, talk my God. Me. It is like being in the future.
Yep.
But obviously it's not the future because it's the present. Like, it is this massive complex. And because I did the 17-hour trip and then had 8-hour layover. And so I just booked into the hotel airport. Yep. And had a couple of hours sleep and then went to the gym and had a swim in their 25-meter pool. And it is like, it's almost like being part of a movie. There's all of this glass, like no access to any outdoors. The lighting was like kind of that, like blue, kind of almost Star Trek type atmosphere to it. And
yeah.
It was awesome. And the pool, so if anyone goes through Doha and they have a few hours, then definitely make the use of the hotel there or even the fitness center itself. Like, it's not cheap. I think the fitness center just to use it with the pool would have been about $65 New Zealand.
Okay, wow. That's a decent one-day rate.
It is. But there were a couple of girls on the same flight as me, and they were part of the NZ cycling team, and they were headed to France, and they had the similar layover. So they just paid that just to go into the gym and do like a 2 or 3 hour training session.
As a one off, you're happy to do it. Like it's not like you're going to be paying that on a daily basis because you're living and training there. But really, is that break and to get the body moving again? Absolutely.
Yes. Yep, totally. And compression socks, my goodness, I'm so glad I wore them because I had to do my long run on the Friday before I jumped on the plane. And I remember arriving in Kona last year with the worst cankles ever. My legs look like your legs.
Well, we think about what my legs look like when I go flying.
Yes. Well, do you wear compression socks?
Yeah, I use compression socks for this flight over. It still got me, though, but not as bad. In saying that, though, I have some really good ones at home, but I forgot to bring them with me, so I purchased some at the airport, and they just weren't quite as compressive as I would have hoped, so maybe that's the difference.
It might be, because I've got some, and I'm not sure the brand, because I stole them off my friend Anna's elite running boyfriend at the time, but I've had the medicinal weight ones from Two Times You, and they were awesome. So,
I had a pair of Two Times You ones that took me used to, and it's not because of the size of my calves, it was how compressive they were. It used to take me about half an hour to get them on and off. I could feel like half my blood pass into my upper body as a result of it.
Yeah, they're brilliant, hey? Like you don't appreciate how good they are until you actually need to use them.
Yeah, well, I don't have a long-haul flight for a while, so I'm pretty glad I'm not having to think about that. So that's a positive at this stage.
It is, Bevan.
Now, we've got Jeremy Davis from Setup Events, who's running the South Carolina Toughman, and he's here now to talk to us a little bit more about that event. Right, so today's Toughman race that we're covering is Toughman South Carolina, and we have Jeremy Davis on the call. So welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Setup Events, how long have you been in the events game?
Oh, goodness, I think since there have been events, it feels like.
that's what it feels like when you are an event director, isn't it? It takes a lot out of you.
It does. I mean, it seems to go on forever and seems to go by so fast. But Setup Events has been around, since the mid-90s. Actually, it was started by a gentleman by the name of Bill Scott. Did his very first triathlon in North Carolina. So we've been actually producing triathlons, I think, since 1994. So what is that, 23 years, something like that?
Wow. Okay. Were you involved in the first incarnation of the race in South Carolina? Because it was the Carolina Half before it became a Toughman event. Were you guys involved in that?
It was. We started that event, and actually it started to be a fairly small event. You know, it was back in the day when there just wasn't actually a lot of iron distance racing in the Southeast, which is surprising considering what you look at now is how many there are. But that race grew from a couple hundred, I think, to the biggest year we had was 800 racers.
Wow, that's a really great turnout. So at what point did you guys look to actually align it with the Toughman series?
You know, I've been talking to Rich for a while, and we had, beached a battleship for a long time, and we kind of focused our efforts on that event. It had grown to, you know, one of the biggest non-branded events in the country.
So you've been involved, because I've heard of the Beached Battleship. It's been around forever, and it's actually recognized as, you know, one of the most popular non-branded long distance triathlons in the American circuit.
Right, it was. And then, of course, we all know the story of Ironman coming in and making that purchase, and mixed reviews. Positive things came out of that, negative things came out of that. But, the biggest negative of that was the drop of the iron distance race, and they just simply have a 70.3 there now. But, you know, so we were talking to Rich, kind of get it back to your question, talking to Rich for a while, and we just were focused on Beach to Battleship. And when that purchase happened, we need another another marquee event on our schedule, kind of that time frame, and South Carolina really only had one iron distance race in the whole state, when at one time I think we had four or five. And I thought, you know, this is a perfect time to make that move. So I gave Rich a call and said, you know, let's go with this. And we're really excited to be a part of the Toughman family, that's for sure.
Well, definitely. It's Rich is doing a great thing in bringing that sort of consistency of a delivery across all of the events. You know, the Toughman series as such is really starting to be on the build. And so it's really nice to be able to align yourself with what Rich is doing and his ethos behind, you know, giving age group athletes a really good, consistent, well-run event.
Right. I think he's done a really good job. I think the key to that is his partners. Obviously, he chooses wisely with the people he partners with. And You don't see any, you know, kind of fly-by-night race directing companies out there under the Tough Men umbrella.
Yeah. Now, the race itself, so typically a wetsuit swim?
Yeah, absolutely. That's seems to be one of the keys these days you have to have to have an iron or a half iron distance race, because, you know, as just like me, the swim is terrifying.
It's a lake swim, though, isn't it, for the Carolina event? But one of the unique features of it, you know, being a lake swim, it's also a point-to-point bike.
It is. So, you know, it creates its own challenges. The original South Carolina half was all held right there within the state park of Lake Greenwood. And, you know, that had its own challenges. So pretty much I think the point-to-point reasoning is twofold. One, the state park really just would not allow us to be back. They had experienced the South Carolina half at the 800 mark, and we pretty much shut down their operations. And as a public taxpayer-funded entity, shutting down a facility like that for an entire day just was not something they were excited about. So, you know, that is reason number one. But reason number two is, and I don't think many people know this, but Uptown Greenwood is just in a flourish state right now. So, you know, I grew up there, and as Uptown Greenwood starts to grow, gets craft breweries and pizza shops and new restaurants and things, I thought, you know, why finish 25 miles away from what is a fantastic place to have a post-race celebration? So that's really kind of the main reason that we're finishing that bike in Uptown Greenwood, which then allows us to finish the run there.
Well, you've just said something that's music to my ears, which is craft beer. so if I wasn't in somewhere else in the States at this particular time in September, I definitely would be down there racing. But one of the things is that in bringing it to an inner city sort of finish, that becomes another highlight in its own right. I mean, I've just come back from the ITU Long Distance Worlds in Penticton in Canada, and, you know, having that ability to actually get some energy and have people watching the event is actually quite important for the athletes to actually have some spectators.
I mean, it really is, and we're starting to see that more and more. I mean, we've been around long enough to kind of see the transformation of the sport, and it used to be, you know, triathlons were out of sight, out of mind, because there were so many triathletes that you could put them on anywhere and everybody would show up, and we wanted to be the least impact that we possibly could be. So that meant state parks out in the middle of nowhere, and you still got, like I said, 800 to 1,000 or more people. But that's starting to change. I think athletes now want to have a racing experience more so than just going out and putting in the miles. And when you finish, you know, just alongside even 800 or 1,000 of your competitors and maybe the 1.3 friends they brought, it's not quite the same as when you're finishing in front of, you know, 500,000 to a million potential spectators. Not obviously everyone doesn't come out, but that downtown setting just provides that bigger feel and that bigger experience. And then, you know, it's a vacation, so to be able to finish up, you know, wear your race medal over to the local bar and have a beer with your buddies, there's just nothing else like it. So that's really why you're seeing this move into the downtown settings for most of these races, big races at least.
Yeah, and it's not always easy to do, but you've obviously got the council and the town on board with actually having the event come into the heart of the city. But you also managed to retain what a lot of athletes like is a little bit of an off-road running path for the run. So it's the Heritage Trail. So as much as they're getting into the city, they're still going to have what is a slightly softer run leg to run on.
Yeah, well, actually, it is a trail by name, but it is paved. So it's one of these rails to trails operations that you see everywhere. Yep. Now. It seems to be the big thing. Yep. But the beauty of that is, it's September in the South. It could be warm. That trail is 100% shaded. So it's flat and shaded. So it's really the perfect run. I mean, the bike course, I'm not going to lie, it's not, it's point to point. You start at a lake. I mean, even basic understanding of topography will tell you you're probably starting at the lowest point.
Yeah.
And wherever you go from there, you're going up. You know, you're not climbing mountains or anything, but it is an uphill bike. I mean, you get, you know, probably about 200 to 300 feet of elevation gain over the entire bike course, which is not huge, but it's enough to feel.
Yeah.
And then when you get on that run, it's, you know, it's flat, shaded, fast. So it's a good reprieve from getting off that bike. You'll definitely be glad when you get off the bike.
And in the south, what kind of temperatures would you expect in and around late September?
I mean, I think we can see a pretty broad range, but for the most part, we expect it to be in the mid to high 60s come race start, and then probably finishing up, you know, the heat of the day. So the 7-hour finishers would see somewhere probably in the high 70s, maybe get into the low 80s. So it should be absolutely perfect.
Perfect racing conditions.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a reason we're not doing it in July.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, Jeremy, it sounds like a wonderful event. It's another – is it after the championship race in New York?
It is. So, it actually, we qualify – we're probably the first event to qualify for the 2018 championships.
Okay. All right, so it's really well placed on the calendar. It'll take some of the momentum from the championship race, and if people are interested in getting to New York for that particular event, then South Carolina is the first place that they can actually look to qualify.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, well, Jeremy, it's on the 30th of September. If anyone listening to the show is interested in what sounds like a wonderful event, jump onto the website, get your entry in there. It's obviously going to be a really spectacular race. So thank you for coming on the show, and good luck.
Thank you so much. Have a great one.
Now, Jeremy's got a great event there at South Carolina, and he's obviously got heaps of experience running that because he had the Beach to Battleships, which I have heard of and is one of that was one of the iconic non-branded iron distance races in the States. So it looks like they're going to put on a really good event there in South Carolina, including getting into the heart of Upper Greenwood, I think it is. So really getting a lot of town support and getting that atmosphere built. So great to see that particular event become a Tough Man branded race. And best of luck with their the first running out of it in September.
Awesome.
Right. So we're off to Vancouver Island today. You're going to go to a music festival this weekend. When do you fly out for home?
I fly out next Friday.
Okay. All right. So next week we'll be in I'll still be in San Fran. Okay. So
yeah,
we're going to do it from San Fran. And where will you be?
I will be probably back in Dunstable.
Dunstable.
I know, which is the name. Like, it's so funny. I rock on up like to the airport. So we come back from Spain on Tuesday night, and then obviously from Spain to the UK, it's international, and you go through with the passport control, and the passport control guy goes, he's like, oh, yeah, so why are you here? And I'm like, oh, I'm here on holiday. And he's like, in Dunstable. And I'm like, yeah.
Vancouver Island and San Fran sound a lot more jet setter than where are you ringing in from? Dunstable.
Dunstable, I know.
Okay, well, you are off to a music festival. I think I'm going to go and, you know, explore the sights and sounds of Vancouver Island. We'll catch up some stage next week.
Next week, yes.
Yeah.
Have a fabulous week, Bevan. Enjoy Vancouver Island. Looking forward to hearing all about it.
And I'm looking forward to hearing about Albo and the music festival. So have fun.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. This show was brought to you by Garmin, the perfect training partner for every endurance athlete. Visit garmin.co.nz today.